So, if I asked you to imagine the exact moment you feel the most pleasure from, like eating a warm, sugary donut, you'd probably say it's the second you take that first bite.
Right, yeah.
But if you look at the actual neuroscience, you'd be wrong. Your brain actually experienced its biggest chemical thrill like 10 minutes earlier when you were just driving down the street and you saw that glowing neon hot and ready sign in the window.
Yeah, the anticipation.
Exactly. By the time the sugar actually hits your tongue, the primary chemical driver of your behavior has, well, it's already moved on.
I'd completely moved on, yeah.
So today we're kind of dismantling everything you thought you knew about the brain's most misunderstood chemical.
Yeah, we are diving into a genuinely paradigm-shifting article. It was just published yesterday, actually, August 24, 2026, in the OOTW Journal.
Right.
And it's titled The Surprise Signal, Dopamine, and the Prediction of Reward. And this piece takes the biggest pop culture myth in modern biology, which is this pervasive idea that dopamine is simply the pleasure molecule. And it completely shatters it. I mean, we're looking at a fundamentally different model of how the brain learns, how it breaks down, and ultimately how we might fix it.
I mean, the popular narrative is just so ingrained in us. We talk about our brains like they're vending machines. You know,
Yeah.
you put in a good experience, like, I don't know, a social media notification or a swipe on a dating app or just a sip of soda, you press the button, and the brain dispenses a little hit of joy called dopamine.
Right, the reward dispenser.
Yeah. But the OOTW Journal article points out that to actually understand the mechanism, you really have to go back to the moment scientists realized that whole vending machine model was entirely backwards.
Yeah, the turning point for this really happened in the late 1980s and 90s, and it was driven largely by this researcher named Wolfram Schultz.
Okay.
And he was conducting these incredibly precise, like landmark experiments, placing microelectrodes into the midbrains of monkeys. Yeah, and he was recording the firing of individual dopamine neurons because he was trying to map out exactly how and when the brain registers a reward.
So, paint the picture of this lab setup for us. Like, how do you even map out a reward in a monkey's brain?
Well, the setup was brilliantly simple, actually. So Schultz trained the monkeys to associate a specific, totally neutral cue, like a light flashing or a tone playing,
Okay.
with an impending reward. So after the light flash, the monkey would get just a few drops of apple juice.
Got it.
Now, the prevailing theory at the time assumed that dopamine was just a biological high five, basically.
Right, like, good job. Here's some pleasure.
Exactly. You taste the sweet juice, the dopamine neurons fire.
And initially, like, before the monkeys actually figured out the game, that is exactly what the data showed, correct?
Yes, early in the training process, that was the result. The juice would arrive unexpectedly, and the dopamine neurons would fire this massive burst of activity at the exact moment the monkey tasted the reward.
Okay, so that makes sense.
But as the trials continued and the monkey started to learn the association, realizing that the flashing light guaranteed the juice was coming,
Right.
the timing of that chemical spike did something that was impossible to explain with the old model.
Hold on. The article said the chemical spike literally traveled backward in time.
Yes.
Like, how is that biologically possible?
Well, the firing pattern migrated completely away from the consumption of the reward and it attached itself to the cue.
Whoa.
So once the monkey learned the pattern, the flashing light would trigger a massive dopamine spike. But seconds later, when the sweet juice was actually delivered to the monkey's mouth,
Yeah.
the dopamine neurons were completely silent.
No way.
Yeah, the reward itself produced a flatline response.
Okay, let's unpack this because this completely upends how we think about our own daily motivations. I mean, if I'm translating this biological data into my own life, it's like ordering a package online. Like, you spend days obsessing over a new pair of shoes, but the massive dopamine hit doesn't happen when you finally cut open the cardboard box in your kitchen. Like, by the time the box is open, the thrill is mostly gone. The actual dopamine rush happens when your phone lights up with that out for delivery notification.
Yes,
That notification is the flashing light.
exactly. What's fascinating here is that the dopamine system is acting as a literal teaching voice. The researchers realized these neurons, they weren't reporting pleasure at all.
Right.
They were reporting a reward prediction error.
Reward prediction error.
Right. It's a mathematical gap between what the brain expects to happen and what actually happens in reality.
So it sounds like the entire system is just built on being surprised.
It is entirely about surprise. So let's look at the three distinct states that Schultz observed. First, you have an unexpected reward. The monkey gets juice out of nowhere.
Right, a nice surprise.
Exactly. That's a positive surprise, a positive prediction error. So dopamine spikes to say, hey, pay attention. Something unexpectedly good just happened.
Okay.
Second, you have a fully predicted reward. The monkey sees the light, expects the juice, and gets the juice. The reality perfectly matches the expectation.
Right.
So there is zero surprise. And the dopamine response is completely flat at the moment of the reward.
Because the brain's model of reality was correct. I mean, there's no new information to learn there.
Exactly.
Okay.
Which leads to the third and really most critical state. What happens if the monkey sees the light, fully expects the sweet juice, but the researchers play a trick and they deliberately withhold it?
Oh, man. The expectation is violated, but in the negative direction.
Right. The dopamine neurons don't just stay flat. They actually pause. They actively dip below their normal resting baseline at the exact millisecond the expected juice fails to arrive.
Right.
It's a negative prediction error. The brain is loudly signaling, you know, the world just surprised you by failing to deliver. You need to downgrade the value of that light.
You know, if our brain is constantly calculating this difference between expected outcomes and actual outcomes to update its internal model of reality,
yeah,
that sounds remarkably similar to how code works.
Yeah.
And the article dives into this moment where biology and computer science just totally collided.
Yeah, the convergence between those two fields in 1997 is honestly one of the most elegant moments in modern science.
It's wild.
Wolfram Schultz teamed up with two computational neuroscientists, Peter Dayan and Red Montague.
Okay.
And they analyzed Schultz's recordings of these monkey neurons, and they realized that this biological dipping and spiking perfectly matched an equation computer scientists had already invented.
Wait, I've heard of this concept in, like, tech news?
Yes.
The equation is called temporal difference learning, right?
Yes.
Isn't that the exact same logic they use to train artificial intelligence to, like, play chess or drive cars?
It is the absolute mathematical backbone of reinforcement learning in AI.
That is crazy.
I mean, think about an AI playing chess. It looks at the board and calculates an expected value. Let's say it expects a 2-point advantage.
Right.
It makes a move. But the human opponent does something brilliant and totally unexpected, resulting in the AI actually being down 1 point.
Okay.
The AI calculates the error. It expected +2, it got -1. So the prediction error is -3.
Got it.
It uses that -3 to update the value of its previous move so it never makes that mistake again.
So a machine learning algorithm running on silicon chips and a living, breathing monkey brain are using the exact same mathematical process to navigate an unpredictable world.
Yeah. The dopamine neurons in the midbrain are literally running a temporal difference algorithm in biological wetware.
Wow.
It's the most efficient way for any learning system, organic or synthetic, to figure out what actions lead to valuable outcomes.
Okay, wait, I have to push back on this, like, highly mechanistic view for a second. Because are we saying humans are just biological algorithms? Like, is my subjective experience of joy, like holding my newborn or loving a really great piece of music, is that just a temporal difference calculation?
Yeah.
Because that feels incredibly bleak.
I completely get that. But the beauty of this research is that it answers your exact concern.
Okay, good.
Your joy is absolutely not a temporal difference calculation. Because dopamine is not the joy.
Oh, man. That is a massive relief.
Right. Dopamine is merely the navigational compass. It's the signal pointing you toward the destination, but it is not the destination itself.
Okay.
And this brings us to a crucial distinction in the OOTW piece, which is the neuroscience of wanting versus liking.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because we intuitively blur those two concepts together all the time.
Constantly.
Like, I just assume that if I want something really badly, it must be because I'm going to like it once I have it.
Yeah, our conscious minds blur them, but our neuroanatomy keeps them strictly separated. Yeah. Wanting is driven by the dopamine prediction error. Neuroscientists call this incentive salience.
Incentive salience.
Right. When dopamine fires, it assigns this magnetic, almost irresistible quality to a cue. It demands your attention and physically drives your motor system to pursue it.
So it's the raw motivation, like the craving.
Exactly. But liking the actual hedonic pleasure, you know, the subjective joy of consuming the reward, that's generated by an entirely different network.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The brain has these microscopic regions called hedonic hotspots. And these hotspots don't run on dopamine at all.
Well, the article mentions they run on opioids and endocannabinoids. So just to translate that, we're basically talking about the brain's naturally produced painkillers and bliss molecules.
Yes, those are the chemicals actually responsible for the feeling of deep satisfaction and pleasure.
You know, applying this split between wanting and liking to daily life, it explains so many of our most frustrating habits.
It really does.
Like, think about the urge to just endlessly scroll on your phone late at night.
Oh.
Your dopamine system sees the phone, which is the cue, and it creates this massive surge of wanting. It assigns immense incentive salience to that glowing screen.
Right.
But how often do you sit there an hour later swiping through videos and realize you are totally miserable?
Exactly. The liking system, those hedonic hotspots, they aren't engaging at all. The joy isn't there, but the drive to continue is just overpowering.
Yeah. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this mechanical split is the fundamental tragedy of addiction.
Okay.
Because when we view addiction through the lens of the reward prediction error, we see exactly how the compass gets permanently broken.
Walk us through that mechanism. Like, why doesn't the brain just learn that the addictive behavior isn't actually making us happy anymore?
Because addictive substances bypass the normal biological dampening process.
What do you mean?
So normally, if you eat a delicious meal, you get a positive prediction error. It was better than expected.
But the second or third time you eat it, your expectation rises to match the reality. The error goes to zero, the dopamine normalizes, and you stop obsessively craving it.
Because you learned its true value,
the
system stabilizes itself.
Exactly. But addictive drugs, they forcefully dump massive amounts of chemical into the synapses every single time they are consumed.
Oh.
They chemically prevent the error from ever resetting to zero.
So from the brain's perspective, the drug is constantly generating artificial prediction error that just loudly proclaims this was infinitely better than expected every single time.
Yes. The brain never adapts to the expectation. It is tricked into thinking it has discovered the single most important survival mechanism on Earth.
Wow.
So the dopamine system updates its model to prioritize the substance above food, above water, above relationships. The wanting just grows to monstrous proportions.
And what about the liking?
Well, meanwhile, the separate hedonic hotspots, that liking system, they are overwhelmed by this chemical onslaught. So to protect themselves, they downregulate. They shrink away and build up tolerance.
So the person is left with this uncontrollable magnetic pull toward a substance.
Yeah.
While the actual capacity to enjoy it completely withers away.
Yeah.
Like they aren't even chasing a high anymore. They're just trapped by a malfunctioning compass.
They are punished with desire while being starved of joy. It's really tragic.
It is. And, you know, we just talked about addiction being a system that's constantly screaming that a reward is coming. But what happens when that system burns out entirely? Like when the brain's capacity to expect anything good just shuts down.
That leads us right into the clinical reality of anhedonia, which is often considered the sort of dark, hollow center of severe depression.
The OOTW Journal cites a paper by Derevakian and Mark Cook from 2012, and they define anhedonia in a way that feels very counterintuitive to how society normally talks about depression.
Right.
Like, they describe it not as a profound sadness, but as a flatness.
Yes.
A world entirely drained of its incentive color.
Yes. We often equate depression with acute emotional pain, but sadness is still an active, vibrant emotion. Anhedonia is a void. It's a specific disorder of the reward circuitry. Research points heavily to a region called the ventral striatum and the dopamine pathways feeding into it.
Oh?
In anhedonia, this entire network becomes drastically under-responsive to positive events.
Let's ground that anatomy for a second. So you can think of the ventral striatum as the brain's central train station for motivation.
I like that, yeah.
In a healthy brain, a positive event, like, I don't know, a beautiful sunset or a hug from a friend that pulls into the station and the manager gets on a loudspeaker to announce it, creating that spark of motivation.
Right.
But in an anhedonic brain, the train pulls in, but the station manager is asleep.
Yeah.
The windows are boarded up. No announcement is made.
That is a perfect analogy. The unexpected good thing happens, but the teaching signal stays completely dim. The brain fails to register the positive prediction error.
So anhedonia isn't feeling terrible all the time. It's feeling nothing. It's the literal absence of surprise.
Yes. And without that biological spark of surprise, the machinery that teaches us what is worth pursuing simply grinds to a halt. You know, you look at a hobby you used to love or a meal you used to savor, and there's just no magnetic pull.
If depression is a train station with boarded up windows, how do we force them back open?
Well, that's the big question.
I mean, the standard treatment for decades has often involved traditional SSRIs, which we've covered in past deep
We
dives.
have, yeah.
And SSRIs can raise the floor so a patient doesn't feel the crushing lows, but they can also lower the ceiling, leaving the person feeling kind of emotionally blunted, like they flatten out the peaks and valleys.
Which is exactly why the frontier of psychiatric research is looking for agents that do the exact opposite of flattening.
Right.
And the article highlights the resurgence of research into classic psychedelics, focusing on their ability to act as powerful agents of neuroplasticity.
See, when people hear psychedelics, they think of hallucinations. They don't immediately think of repairing a broken dopamine compass.
No, they don't. And we must be really precise with the mechanism here.
Okay.
Classic psychedelics like psilocybin, they do not act directly on dopamine receptors.
Oh, they don't.
No, they don't flood the ventral striatum with artificial dopamine. Instead, they bind primarily to serotonin receptors, specifically the 5-HT2A receptor.
Yeah.
But those serotonin networks sit upstream of the reward circuits. They modulate how the whole system communicates.
The article references a 2021 study by Hesselgrave and colleagues that really illustrates this. And they worked with mice that had been subjected to chronic stress.
Right.
These mice exhibited classic anhedonic behavior, like they completely gave up pursuing a sweet sugar water reward that they normally loved. Their reward system had essentially just shut down.
Exactly. And the researchers administered a single dose of psilocybin to these stressed mice,
Just one.
just one dose. And over the following days, the anhedonic behavior reversed. The mice regained their motivation and began pursuing the sweet reward again. Their capacity for incentive salience returned.
But the wild part of this study, like the part that really made me reread the paragraph,
Yeah.
is how they proved the underlying mechanics of what was happening in the mouse brain.
Oh, this is the best part. So the researchers ran a parallel group of mice where they administered the psilocybin, but they simultaneously injected a secondary drug that completely blocked the serotonin 2A receptor.
So they put a chemical roadblock over the exact receptor responsible for the psychedelic trip.
Exactly. With that receptor blocked, the hallucinogenic effects cannot physically occur.
So what does this all mean?
Yeah.
Like, the mice received the active compound, their trip receptor was chemically blocked, so they weren't experiencing any altered state of consciousness, but the data showed their anhedonia was still reversed.
Yes. And this raises an important question that is currently shaking up the entire field of psychiatry.
I bet.
The study demonstrated that even with the hallucinogenic pathway blocked, the psilocybin successfully strengthened excitatory synapses in the reward-related circuitry.
Okay, let's translate excitatory synapses.
Please do.
I like to think of this using a snow globe metaphor.
Okay.
So depression and anhedonia are like ski tracks in the snow that have frozen deep into solid ice, right? Your thoughts and motivations are stuck completely in those same frozen grooves.
Right, you can't get out of them.
Exactly. Strengthening excitatory synapses is like shaking the snow globe. It lays down a fresh layer of powder, making it physically easier for a new signal to jump across the gap between neurons and carve a new path.
That's beautifully put. The psilocybin is reopening a critical window of neuroplasticity. It allows a stuck, under-responsive reward system to physically rewire itself.
It's not just a band-aid.
No, it's not forcing a massive artificial dopamine spike like an addictive drug either. It is repairing the background machinery so that natural, everyday dopamine prediction errors can register again.
Wow.
It literally allows the brain to relearn how to be surprised by good things.
That is an incredibly hopeful view of where mental health treatment is heading. But we have to look at the caveats here.
We do.
Because the OOTW Journal is very careful not to oversell this as some kind of magic bullet.
Right, the cautions are absolutely vital here. First, regarding the dopamine system itself. Yes, the reward prediction error is a massive breakthrough, but dopamine is a deeply complex, messy system.
It does a lot of things.
It regulates fine motor movement, which is why the death of dopamine neurons causes Parkinson's disease.
Ah, right.
It heavily influences working memory. It also fires in response to aversive negative events, not just rewards. So if we reduce dopamine entirely to just surprise, we risk falling into the exact same intellectual trap as calling it the pleasure molecule.
Yeah, we just end up swapping one bad vending machine metaphor for another.
Precisely. Secondly, the Hesselgrave study, while profound, is preclinical. It was conducted on mice.
Right.
While human clinical trials for psilocybin and depression are showing remarkable promise, we cannot definitively say that the exact synaptic rewiring seen in a mouse model translates perfectly to a human brain experiencing complex trauma.
It's a different scale.
It's a hypothesis under rigorous investigation, not a settled fact yet.
And it is definitely worth stating the obvious. I mean, these are deeply powerful controlled substances.
Yes.
They are not safe for everyone, especially those with certain psychiatric histories. You can't just take them recreationally and expect your excitatory synapses to magically cure your anhedonia.
Absolutely not. The clinical container is everything. When a compound opens up a massive window of neuroplasticity, you are making your brain incredibly vulnerable and malleable.
Right.
You require professional psychological support to actively shape that new snow, to use your metaphor, into healthy patterns.
Well said. So to pull all of these complex threads together, you know, we started our journey in the 1990s with Wolfram Schultz's juice-drinking monkeys.
We did.
Discovering that our chemical motivation fires backward onto the cue of expectation.
Right.
We saw how that biological math perfectly mirrors the algorithms teaching artificial intelligence how to conquer chessboards. We untangled the deeply tragic split between wanting and liking, showing how drugs hijack our prediction error to create a compass that constantly spins out of control.
Yeah.
We looked into the void of anhedonia, where the train station windows are boarded up and that surprise signal just goes completely dark.
Yeah. And finally, we explored the frontier of neuroplasticity, where compounds like psilocybin might physically shake the snow globe and let the light of surprise back in.
Exactly. And if there is one practical takeaway for the listener to really observe in their own life today, it is to start paying attention to that gap between wanting and liking.
Oh, yeah.
Next time you feel an overpowering urge to check your phone or buy something you don't need, just pause and ask yourself if your hedonic hotspots are actually going to enjoy the experience.
Right.
Or if your dopamine prediction error is just blindly yelling at you. Recognizing the mechanism gives you immense agency over your habits.
That is fantastic advice. I'm definitely going to try to catch myself the next time I am, like, mindlessly scrolling and just ask, am I actually liking this? It takes practice, for sure, but just naming the biological illusion can break its power.
Yeah. So as we wrap up this deep dive into the OTW Journal, mm-hmm. I want to leave everyone with a lingering thought. It built on everything we just discussed about our brains being fundamentally driven by the mathematical gap between expectation and reality.
Okay. What is the thought?
Well, if our biological drive, you know, our capacity for motivation, is strictly fueled by surprise, by encountering the unexpected, then we have to look really critically at the way we've designed our modern society.
How so?
Think about it. We've built a world obsessed with creating perfectly predictable, comfortable routines.
We really have.
We rely on algorithms that perfectly predict what movie we want to watch. We have same-day delivery that entirely eliminates the wait. We use GPS systems that ensure we never experience the surprise of getting lost.
Oh, wow. So we are systematically engineering all friction and therefore all surprise out of our daily existence.
Exactly. So the question is, does our modern obsession with perfectly predictable lives actually wire our brains for apathy?
That's a huge question.
If we use technology to eliminate all surprise, do we accidentally turn off the very biological signal that makes life feel meaningful?
Wow.
Keep that in mind the next time your day goes exactly according to plan. We will see you on the next deep dive.